This is an interview with David Burgers for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is August 4th, 2015, and we're in Boston, Massachusetts. So thank you very much for agreeing to speak with us today. We usually start with a little bit of personal background. I gather that you're from this area originally?
Actually, born in Mount Kisco, New York, okay. Westchester County. But I came up to this area for college in the 80s, Eastern Nazarene College. And except for a few years away in law school and at a law firm in Philly, I've been up in the Boston area.
Okay, so you were telling me just before we started that you are a history major as an undergrad?
That's right, history major. Love what history can teach us.
Terrific. And then you went straight to Yale Law School.
No. My first stop was at Pepperdine University. I went to my first year of law school there. And at the end of the year, I had done well and felt like transfer might make a lot of sense. I came to the conclusion that California is a beautiful state, but if I could transfer to Yale, I would do it. So Yale took 12 transfers a year, and I had the opportunity to go to Yale for the second and third year and graduate from Yale.
Terrific. Had you always intended on getting into law when you were an undergrad?
You know, that's a good question. I think I always thought that the law was a good avenue to get into public service. Mm-hmm. And it was for that reason that I was thinking law school would be a good option.
Okay. And did you have any notions in law school of what you were going to end up doing with it? Did you want to be a litigator or in corporate law?
Yeah. I started out at my first law firm, Choate Hall & Stewart, with a split between corporate and litigation. It was one of the only people that had the because those are two very all-consuming disciplines. Mm-hmm. But I think growing up and in college, I always thought a litigator is a lawyer. And so thinking about litigation was on my mind a lot.
Okay, so what sort of cases then at that first firm?
So I started at Choate, which was a good-sized firm, at least in the early 90s in Boston. Still is mm-hmm. a very respected firm here, but it's about the same size, whereas a lot of other firms have grown, combined, and some have gone away. So starting out, I really just did a lot of document review as a first-year associate. And very soon after I got there, I thought, I like the people here, but I'd love to get some hands-on litigation experience. And so I actually left Choate the year after I got there and went to a plaintiff's firm, litigation firm, right outside of Philadelphia called Lowenthal & Abrams. And there did all sorts of plaintiff's work. Everything you could imagine. That included commercial litigation, included personal injury, included defamation cases, just whistleblower cases, everything. And, you know, got trial experience there, arbitration, mediation experience, and had actually met my wife when I was at Choate, and then she moved down and we got married down there. So she was a born and bred Bostonian. Mm-hmm. And after 2.5 years in Philly, she said, David, it's time to come home. Her home, that is. And I actually called Choate Hall & Stewart back up and said, listen, I've got some great litigation experience. Love to come back. Fortunately, I hadn't burned any bridges and was able to return to Choate and be there about 3 more years from 95 to 98. So the work that I did at Choate that second time was really probably the beginning of what led to me focusing in the securities laws, because that's where I actually started working. I represented broker-dealers there, investment advisors, represented one client in connection with an SEC investigation. So I just really started to understand a little bit more about that space and found it very fascinating.
Was that something you fell into, or were you aiming in that direction?
I wasn't aiming there. What happened was that we had someone that had come from the SEC to Choate Hall & Stewart named Jim Adelman. Jim Adelman worked for the SEC both in Washington and in Boston, and he was intent on kind of starting up a newer and stronger practice at Choate that focused on the securities laws, SEC, and I started working with him. And it just really interested me, fascinated me, because so many people need good advice, they need good counsel in this area, and getting it right and helping companies get it right was really fascinating.
So then, excuse me, in 1998, you went to the SEC then.
Yep.
Was that, you mentioned earlier that you had kind of wanted to get into public service. Was that something that had been on your mind throughout?
Yeah, it was drawing me. And, you know, obviously, like many people, I had law school loans. And so starting at a firm where I could work on those loans was something I thought about. But I was always in the back of my mind, that it'd be nice to get into public service. And so, you know, combining an interest in the securities laws with the opportunity to be in public service was attractive. I had started talking to Jim Adelman mm-hmm. because he had returned to the SEC. And so he was saying, this would be a great place for you to come. But I also had some things that I needed to finish up and cases at Choate Hall and Stewart.
Was he in enforcement?
He was in enforcement, okay. Yep. And so ultimately was able to finish up those matters and then join the SEC. So it was a great combination of both the interest of public service and the work that I was enjoying.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the SEC then. What sort of things were you involved with? You went to the Division of Enforcement.
Yep, I became a staff attorney in the Division of Enforcement. When I got there, I think the office had probably between 70 and 80 people.
Mm-hmm. And this is the Boston office.
This is the Boston office, and that would be both of the exam side and the enforcement side. And I was one of the staff lawyers. And I tell you, just a wide variety of matters that I was fortunate to work on. One involving, this was right, you know, probably in the first year and a half that I got there. One involving an investment company and a trader who had exceeded his authority. Another one was a Ponzi scheme. Another one related to financial fraud. Another one was an insider trading case. So just the whole spectrum of enforcement investigations were on my plate, and that was very exciting.
Big companies, individual offenders.
Yeah, a little bit of everything. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, from the big companies, the trader that exceeded his authority, the company there was sanctioned by the SEC relating to supervision and oversight, mm-hmm. and then we had Ponzi schemes and other schemes that involved individuals. So, and there were individuals that were charged even in connection with the larger entity.
Okay, so you stayed there for a couple years, and then you kind of had an interim at a broker-dealer?
So I started there in 98. In 2000, I actually was promoted to branch chief, which is the next level of supervision. But shortly after that, just from a financial perspective, I was starting to think it would be nice to stay in this space, meaning the security space, but move back to the private sector. And there was an opportunity at Tucker Anthony, which was at that time a regional brokerage firm. They also had an affiliated investment advisor named Freedom Capital. So I went over there to become assistant general counsel at the broker-dealer and also served as primary counsel to their affiliated investment advisor that had about $8 or $9 billion in assets under management.
Okay, how did you find that experience moving into that
area? Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, it taught me a lot, and I'm very grateful that I had that experience early in my career. Because I learned about how the business functions. I was in the legal and compliance department. I helped rewrite a number of the supervisory procedures and learned how business gets done and how clients get served. And that was really helpful to me in everything that I've done since then. It's just kind of having that base.
Mm-hmm. Was it really different from having been at a law firm?
Yeah, because when you're at a law firm, it's a great experience, but you're not living the business every day. Mm-hmm. You're giving counsel to people that are your clients. They take it or they don't take it. They do what they decide to do, but you're not part of the enterprise and, you know, jointly aiming towards that enterprise succeeding for a long period of time. It's kind of in and out for whatever the period of time is. So when you're with a company, you're actually part of the enterprise in a much different way.
So you were there, though, from 2000 to 2001, and then you were back at the SEC.
About a year and a half I was there. And the reason I left was because Tucker Anthony got bought out by RBC Dane Rauscher. And at the time, I think there may have been an opportunity to move to Minneapolis. That was not something my wife thought would make sense for us.
It's my hometown.
Is that right? Well, it's just something I had never been there. And so at the same time, there was an assistant director position. At that time, it was called assistant district administrator position, opened back at the Boston office. So I applied for that position and got the position and returned, you know, again, only about a year and a half later.
So what were your responsibilities then in this new position?
So at that point, I probably won't get the numbers perfect, but I was responsible for two branches. So that means two branch chiefs would have reported to me. Within each branch, there's usually 3 to 5 staff lawyers, one maybe an accountant or two, paralegal, mm-hmm. But it was two branches of enforcement. And so it was just expanded responsibility from when I left, but still investigating cases, sometimes bringing them all the way to litigation. There was a trial unit that would sometimes join when a case got to litigation, but also would be involved in working through trial strategy and investigation strategy.
Roughly, how many branch chiefs would there have been, say, at the Boston office?
In 2001?
Yeah, around that time.
I would say there were probably four or five branch chiefs at the time. There were two assistant directors. I came in and was one of them. And so each of us would have had two, but there may have been a third. One of the assistant directors may have had a third. So that's probably, and so at that time there might have been 30 enforcement attorneys, somewhere in that number.
Okay, so were the responsibilities divvied up in any particular way between you and the other assistant district administrator?
I think that I probably stepped into the shoes of the person who had departed as assistant. That was a guy named Dave Martyr, and he went to private practice. So I think I stepped into his shoes and just took over the branches that he was supervising.
Were you still kind of seeing that whole gamut of cases?
Oh, yeah. Just a real large number of... Or excuse me, a large variety of cases. I think that what was interesting, and we may get to talk about this later, is Boston has always had a very interesting mix of cases. The Boston office, significant focus on investment advisor and 40 Act cases, just because of where we are. We've got so many mutual funds. We've got hedge funds in Connecticut. So there's always a focus on investment management. But we also saw some really interesting cases on the insider trading front, really interesting financial fraud cases, and always your prime bank schemes, your Ponzi schemes. Mm-hmm. So a really interesting mix.
So those sorts of things like insider trading, Ponzi scheme, those are just always kind of there as part of the
bank. Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Maybe we'll talk about some of the specific cases later.
Sure.
Particularly at this time, when you come back to the SEC, there are a couple of big... new sets of rules. First, there's Reg FD, and then there's, of course, Sarbanes-Oxley. Did that affect the enforcement cases that you are seeing? Those new rules?
Well, yes and no. Anytime there's a new rule, there's a bit of ramp up. So companies and individuals are getting used to the new rules. When you're in enforcement, you're looking as enforcement lawyers. We are looking at the new rules and what the impact was on firms, and keeping our eyes open for potential violations of the new rules. So we did have some, during the period I was there, we had investigations relating to FD. We had we would always look, once Sarbanes-Oxley was in place, at the CEO and CFO certifications. Did they do make their certifications? What was their approach for making the certifications? If there was a financial fraud, that would be something we'd look at as well, is that there's additional rules in place that govern what is supposed to be done internally. Did that actually happen? So I think in the same way that anytime there's been even a rule change, that affects and changes how we investigate, we would have taken that into account when we looked at matters.
Is there any sense that, you know, as companies are getting used to new rules, that they're kind of feeling their way around the meaning of them? Do you see that at the SEC level?
I think a lot of times we would hear from companies the concern about regulating through enforcement, and that particularly when there was an issue that was not fully resolved, whether it's a new rule or whether it's an old rule that hadn't adapted to new technology, are we enforcing something that people didn't really understand was a rule or didn't understand that interpretation was a rule? And then after a few years that a rule is in place, people start understanding, okay, this is what's expected. So I think anytime there's been a new rule or a new amendment, there's been a period where people are really trying to understand what is it that we're supposed to do and how do we get it done, and expressing significant concern anytime enforcement would investigate it, that we as enforcement, when I was enforcement, need to be aware that firms are trying to get it right. They just need to understand what the expectations are.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard is in Reg FD in particular, that there was a kind of grace period in the year or so after it was put into place. Did you get direction on things like that, or on just general enforcement priorities from Washington and the enforcement division there?
Well, I'd answer in two ways. One, we did certainly get some direction from Washington in terms of priorities for the Division of Enforcement, whether that was Dick Walker or Steve Cutler or Linda Thompson or Rob Kazami, our directors of enforcement would articulate visions. Our commissioners would talk about what they were most concerned about, and that would help us to prioritize. I don't remember ever hearing from any enforcement director, we're going to give grace periods. Mm-hmm. But I think the focus was more on, these are our priorities.
Right, right. Were there any certain priorities that stuck out to you as particularly significant during your time there at the SEC?
Well, you know what Linda Thompson would say so many times is that we have a broad set of responsibilities and we really need to cover the waterfront. Mm-hmm. And so from her perspective, yes, we needed to be attentive to new issues, but we also need to make sure we were doing the bread and butter cases that are so important to the integrity of the markets. So that was, I remember her saying that a number of times. As different issues arose and came to the forefront, there would be a certain amount of additional attention that we would devote to those issues because it was clear that this became a higher priority. So, you know, for example, in the early 2000s, the market timing. That was something that was certainly not the top priority of any office leading into that. But then after September 3rd, 2003, I think that was the date, when Elliott Spitzer filed the Canary case, that became a higher priority. Some priorities were driven by external events, such as that. Other priorities were driven by internal work and internal review of the types of complaints and trends that we were seeing.
So that is one of the things that I wanted to talk about in some detail,
Sure.
those cases that came up in that period. So first of all, you mentioned earlier that being in Boston, you do tend to see quite a few investment management cases, basically no matter what historical period we happen to be in.
Absolutely.
So did you have any sense ahead of when this broke and Spitzer filed against Canary you were seeing more cases in that area, or anything?
When you talk about that area, you mean the investment management space?
Yeah, the investment management space.
You know, if you look back at that time period, I think what you'd see is our office, the Boston office, generally did bring more cases in the investment management space than any other office in the country. Sometimes parallel with New York, but still just a significant number.
By virtue of the significance in the region of...
By virtue of just... These are our registrants.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of investment companies. A lot of advisors. What I was going to draw a distinction is between investment management and investment companies. So your question is, did I see a lot of activity in the investment company space? The answer would be no. Did I see a lot of activity in the investment management space? The answer is yes. So, you know, at that time, it could have been, we looked at back in 2000, 2001, hot IPOs. How are they being allocated? And that was significant. You could look at statistical analyses of, you know, different funds that were getting what seemed to be a disproportionate share of hot IPOs. And that would be in the investment management space. There would be, there's always a question of how investors are learning about conflicts and what are the disclosures for conflicts that are made by investment advisors. So we were always looking at that. I wouldn't say there was a high degree or level of activity in the investment company space.
I know that one of the things that was happening at the policy level in the SEC is that there was, prior to all this, a certain amount of interest in mutual fund governance.
Mm-hmm.
Did that
Yes.
have an enforcement component as well?
Not as significant, at least in Boston. I think that was an area where investment management, our division of investment management, really wanted to focus on how it all worked and is it working in the right way for the shareholders and the investors themselves. But that was not something that we were looking hard at from an enforcement perspective, the governance mm-hmm. itself. We were looking at governance more broadly, and often that would come to fruition in the public company space. So, for example, in those years, 2000, 2001, 2002, I remember bringing cases relating to directors of public companies and them not understanding their roles as members of the audit committee or members. So governance more broadly was something that was a focus, from an enforcement perspective, not so much at the investment company level.
I see. One of the, of course, Spitzer is well known for his rhetoric and in particular for knocking on the SEC's vigilance in some of these areas. So
yep.
some of the claims that you see at this time is that things like market timing were common knowledge. I mean, was that, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I guess it all depends on how do you define that? Common knowledge by whom and in what context? You know, clearly some of the activities that were investigated were activities that we learned had been going on for quite some time. So clearly they were common knowledge to some people. You know, the question is whether they're common knowledge to members of enforcement who would be looking for violations of the laws. And that's not as clear to me, because I can only speak for what I knew and what I saw at that time. So I think it was, in my opinion, it was a surprise to most people that were investigating it how prevalent the practices were, how those practices were so designed to benefit the individuals engaged in the practices. But what do I mean by practices? Well, we had a number of different issues, right? It was market timing and you know, short-term trading by not just investors in a fund, but by the portfolio managers, the very people that ran the fund. And to me, when I look back, that was probably some of the most troubling allegations, right? That you have people that are managing the fund that are engaging in short-term trading.
So how often would cases come from things like inspection and examination? Of course, you have those staff here in Boston as well. And one of the claims is that there simply weren't enough resources for those people to be investigating these companies in the depth necessary to uncover some of these
things. There's always something to resource concerns, right? Mm-hmm. The fewer resources you have, the more you have to spread your resources across a wide spectrum of issues. You know, at any given time, we might have had, it changed throughout the years, but anywhere from 1,200 to 1,300 registered investment advisors in our region. It went, and as far as broker-dealers, I think we might have had around 500 at a peak. It may be down to 400 now. So an awful lot of regulated entities to monitor and inspect. And of course, you've seen the broad discussion about resources and the fact that, at least on the investment advisor side, there's no SRO, no FINRA. So it's, if the federally registered investment advisors aren't inspected by the SEC, no one's inspecting them. And that time period can be anywhere up to from 8 to 12 years if you look at the average. Mm-hmm. And in that time, an investment advisor can rise and fall. So that did create issues with really getting to finding all the issues, finding all the concerns. So that's true. I think we, but in response to your original question, we actually saw a great deal of referrals from the exam group based on what they did see. And that was really fascinating, just the things that would come up. The regulated entity cases were, once again, something that the Boston office brought at a higher rate than the SEC's averages, and many of them were investment advisor cases. So it was a great relationship, and that relationship changed over the years, and I'm happy to talk about that. But even back in the early 2000s, there was definitely a focus on what are the investment management examiners, the IA examiners, and the broker-dealer examiners finding. I do think that 2003 was a banner year in that it showed the importance of even closer coordination between exam and enforcement. And I do think that from that year on, you saw even closer integration between the two units. Now, obviously, exam is doing one thing, enforcement is doing another, but that was probably a year where I would say you saw deeper and deeper relationships and work together between the groups.
I guess I'd like to stay on the topic for a little bit, so it'll be a little bit of a tangent.
That's okay.
From what we're talking about. First, would there be certain kinds of things that the examination process would turn up? Would it be more on the accounting side, or would it be, you know, some sorts of practices more than others that you would get from them in terms of referrals?
A big focus always was what the disclosures were versus the actual practices. I would say the vast majority of cases that were filed by the Boston office related to conflicts and how they were disclosed. And that you see that across the board in almost every single case. What's the disclosure and what's the conflict that's not being disclosed or not being clearly disclosed? You know, the whole concept of conflicts is not all conflicts can be eliminated. So you want to mitigate the conflicts that you identify, and then you want to disclose the conflicts that can't be mitigated or eliminated. And so when the staff would go in, they're looking, what is this firm doing, and how does that compare with what it describes it was going to do? It gets wrapped up and dressed up a lot of different ways, but ultimately cases come down usually to that. So it really comes down to the basics: lying, cheating, stealing, and are you doing one of those, and which one of the rules are you violating? But ultimately, that's what you're doing to a client.
And you mentioned a few moments ago that there was an evolution in this area over time, and I'm wondering, since we may forget to come back to it, what did you see in terms of evolution?
So I think that the market timing years were the first time since I joined in 98 where you saw what a lot of people would look at as a crisis in regulatory oversight, saying, did we miss something as an agency, or even more broadly than that, as to what was happening in funds, and how do we get to the bottom of this? And so that necessitated our lawyers, who were not necessarily industry experts, to coordinate closely with our examiners, who did know the industry better. And it formed a model that I think lasted. And that's a model that you've seen, I had seen throughout the years since then. It's just more close coordination, more committees being formed that had significant involvement from exam. At that same time, in enforcement, there was an interesting change. We had a group, which you've probably heard about in other interviews, called the Branch Office, Branch Regional Office Assistance, Branch Office of Regional Assistance, and then it became OCC, Office of Chief Counsel. Current head is Joe Brenner. Joan McCown, longtime head of that office. In 2003 and 4, they were organized geographically. So there would be a person or two that would serve the Boston office, the New York office, maybe Chicago or something like that. And they'd help you get your matters through, help get comments from all the divisions down there. I believe it was 2004, Steve Cutler made the decision, we're going to change probably Joan was involved in the decision too, we're going to change the Office of Chief Counsel to be substance-based, specialty-based, so that one person in there was responsible for investment advisors, investment company issues, another person responsible for broker-dealer issues, another person's responsible for public issuers. So trying to get more expertise and knowledge into the enforcement division itself, and adding to that closer coordination with others with expertise.
So you yourself actually had a change in title to Associate District Administrator. It was around this time, I think?
Yeah, in 2003, mm-hmm. I went from Assistant District Administrator to Associate District Administrator. What that meant effectively was that I was in charge of enforcement at the Boston office. And that was probably in the middle of 2003, and that probably meant, I don't know if the numbers were all remained the same, so let's just say there were four or five branches, mm-hmm. a couple of assistant directors, and then I was in charge of that group.
Okay. So now, as far as the unfolding of these cases, when it didn't start out very well for the Boston office. Basically, there was the Prudential case where there was a whistleblower who ended up eventually going to the
Putnam,
yes. Mm-hmm. Did I say Prudential?
Mm-hmm.
I apologize.
That's
Putnam.
Okay.
Yes. And then eventually it goes to the Massachusetts regulator, and they're the ones who initially opened the case. And I guess that this had fallout here in the Boston office. Maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. There were a number of articles that came out relating to a whistleblower who had said that he had come to the Boston office of the SEC first, that the Boston office didn't act on his complaint, that he went to the Massachusetts Securities Division, that division did act on his complaint, and the questions raised were, what is the SEC doing? What is the Boston office doing? And that certainly, the full story is never always laid out in the papers, but the impact of that was significant to the office, because we had people that were just incredibly committed, incredibly devoted to the protection of investors, who kind of saw those articles every single day, and it really was disheartening. Even to this day, there's a lot of issues that were circling at that time. What I can tell you is that it was an opportunity for us to say, okay, regardless of whether the answers that are being put out there are fully accurate, whether there's other issues that we're circling, what we know is it's true, is we always want to make sure we're listening to every single whistleblower, regardless. We want to make sure that...
There's a large volume, of course, that you have to deal with.
Exactly. So the question is how to do it in the right way. What's also interesting, and this comes back to my earlier point, that some of the worst conduct that I saw was conduct relating to the actual investment managers themselves, portfolio managers. The allegation by the whistleblower that went to the SEC and then went to the to Massachusetts were that there was a group of boilermakers trading in the fund, and that was being allowed. One thing that we always were limited by is what was the language in the prospectuses. And we would look at prospectus and say, if the prospectus says we do not allow this, then there was an obligation on the part of the mutual fund manager not to allow it. If the prospectus said we may stop this or we may prevent it, it changes completely whether or not there's been a disclosure violation. And so one of the difficulties that didn't get a lot of play in the press was that some of the disclosures by fund companies, including fund companies that we're talking about, were of the May variety, which meant it was very difficult to show a violation even if you didn't like the conduct, but that there are other frameworks for the law that say if it's just an unjust and unequitable practice, you can bring an action. For us, what we had to show is that there was actually a misstatement, and that was harder for us to do given our parameters than other regulators.
So then after this, there's... the number of cases expands, and I guess that there are several here in the Boston area as well as in other parts of the country. Tell me a little bit about how the office became involved in that and how those cases developed.
Sure. Well, you know, without getting into any particular case, again, it was kind of a natural outcome based on where we are and the number of mutual funds here. You know, once this became clear that this was a practice in some funds, it was just a natural assumption that, well, we need to look at all the fund companies or a significant number of them to see what's going on. We had a number of these fund companies right in our backyard, and so we became very much involved, not just in following up on issues that came out with the first filing, but in looking more deeply across the fund companies in the region. And so as a result, from 2003 to 2005, we brought cases against quite a few mutual fund companies with very significant settlements relating to practices that became more public in 2003. They were different. You know, some were about the prospectus disclosure says we don't allow this, and yet they did. Others were about portfolio managers and other insiders trading in the account, but all of them related to the short-term trading.
And as far as cooperation with other offices, of course, there are the state regulators. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you working on some of the same cases that Elliot Spitzer was working on? Did his authority under the Martin Act extend up here to businesses based in New England, but that may have traded in New England?
There were definitely cases that we worked alongside the Elliot Spitzer's teams. There were other cases that we worked together and coordinated, or at least communicated with Mass Securities Division. And, you know, the one thing that we saw with the states is that they had a big advantage. And the big advantage is that they were able to be nimble. They were able to move quickly. And that's a real positive aspect. And it's something that we tried to change as we move forward, too, is how do we move more quickly? But that came later. We took a long time to change some of the practices that we'd had in place. But that was something that always, it was hard because the state was always ready to move before the SEC was, but it was also good because the state was sometimes the early warning mechanism where they're going to hear about an issue or a complaint first, and if we develop a good relationship, we can work with them. That was also a change, I'd say, from 2003 forward is in the Boston office, from 2003 to the time I left in 2013, there was a real growth in strengthening of the relationship between our office and the Massachusetts Securities Division, the person in charge of the division, Brian Lantain, you know, real heart for investors, really cares about investors, and just wants to do what he can to protect them. And so I think really coming to terms and understanding that we're coming from different places, we have different mandates, but we share the mandate of protection for investors. And I think that really helped us over the ensuing years from 03 forward to improve and our relationships and work more closely together. That was probably one of the strongest relationships that I ended up having with another state was with Mass Securities Division.
What was at the root of their ability to be nimble, as you put it? Of course, Spitzer had the Martin Act, which was specific to New York.
Well, obviously, every state has its own parameters from an enforcement and the legal parameters for bringing a case. But what they also could do is they could go and issue a subpoena the same day they had a problem or a question. That's not something we could do until 2009. We had to, spend several weeks. Unless we were going to get an emergency formal order giving us subpoena authority, we needed to go through this significant process with comments from the divisions, get to the commission, and then issue a subpoena. So it was just it took a lot longer to get things done.
So in developing these series of cases, what was your experience with the companies themselves? Did they tend to be evasive? Was there a level of cooperation once this was cracked open?
I think this was a really tough time for a lot of mutual fund companies. I think that, yes, we uncovered practices that shouldn't have been in place. But it kind of took that industry by surprise a bit. The mutual fund industry had not had a significant set of negative regulatory issues, really hadn't at all. And you start with the old MFS, one of the oldest mutual fund companies in the country, or maybe it is the oldest from different stories. So I think it was hard for them to figure out how to deal with this because they just hadn't addressed it. I don't feel now, looking back, that we faced a lot of opposition or a lack of cooperation. It did take a while just to work through the issues because there's a lot of analysis and a lot of trading that needed to be reviewed to really understand what happened.
So there are some later cases then that develop as well surrounding things like the valuation of mutual funds. Mm-hmm. And then I know that there was, just from reading the newspaper archives, there was a probe into whether or not people were receiving gifts at Fidelity. Did those stem off of these cases, or were those just separate issues?
No, they were separate, but I think they demonstrated the principle that was made clear in 2003 is that there's no one that gets a pass. And I'm not saying that meant that mutual funds got a pass, but it means that everyone may have an issue, and we've got to make sure that we are diligent to keep checking everybody. And so I do think that the market timing brought mutual funds to a higher degree of scrutiny just going forward than had existed before that. So again, not necessarily because one led to the other, but it's just that there was, I think, a higher level of scrutiny applied to the funds by enforcement after market timing. So valuation, we're really looking at all aspects that we had. The valuation case related to a major mutual fund that essentially it was a fund that held mostly mortgage-backed securities, and it was overvaluing those securities. One of the problems was it just didn't have the right system in place for valuation. Would rely on, say, for example, a broker that would give them some price quotes, but wasn't actually purchasing it. Just wasn't reliable pricing mechanisms. And that ultimately inures to the detriment of investors. So once again, that's a disclosure issue, right? The question of essentially giving gifts in exchange for trading business. Once again, are you using investor assets or fund assets to benefit yourself because you're getting gifts in exchange for directing brokerage to a particular broker dealer. So once again, it ends up being very simple. There's a lot of rules, but how are you taking care of investors' money? How are you disclosing to investors what you're doing with their money? And that's really the heart of just about every single case that gets brought in the investment management space. Actually, I would say almost any space, but it does come down to those basics.
coming back to what you were saying about how this took the industry by surprise, was it your experience once you started developing these cases that their compliance was not simply at the same place as, say, the broker-dealer compliance would be?
Now, that varied, I think, from fund to fund. I think every fund felt like they had a good compliance structure in place, and I think for many, in many aspects they did. But I also think that there were certain things that compliance just wasn't overseeing, wasn't looking at, you know, within funds, and was actually at times surprised to find that this was a problem. So, again, I don't think that we went in and found the compliance programs to be missing, but there were gaps.
Mm-hmm. And then another element of this is the level of penalties that you sought, which were quite large in a number of these cases. Were those based on a kind of formula as to the damages that had occurred, or was there an attempt to be punitive or to set a precedent in this area to discourage this culture?
Yeah, this teed up another interesting problem that the SEC had, is that we could not seek restitution. We could only seek disgorgement. So what we were trying to find is a formula that allowed the SEC to recover for investors the losses and that were created by virtue of the short-term trading, the dilution of the funds. So what we ended up with is the restitution, or the disgorgement, was a restitutionary form of disgorgement, trying to focus more on, you know, how much had been lost from the fund as opposed to how much the funds had, fund managers had collected. It still had to be within this range, though, that we couldn't get back more than they had collected. But we looked at the restitution amount as kind of a way to measure that. Then as far as the penalties go, which is really, I think, where your question is directed, they were high penalties. But in part, the nature of the penalties was driven by the significant amount of harm that was done. So, you know, penalties are punitive in nature. You know, penalty is not intended, at least at first blush, to recover money for investors. It is intended to be punitive. It is intended to say, you did this, you shouldn't have done it. There were certain factors as a result, and this is the penalty that you pay for it. So I do think that there was an effort to think about, what do these penalties mean? What messages are they going to send? But I think they were also trying to drop, the penalties were driven in part by how big the damages were.
So the last thing that I want to ask about in this area is your personal involvement. I gather that you are quite directly involved with all of these investigations. Was there a heavy coordination responsibility, since they're all sort of related cases?
These were the priority cases, the biggest ones we were working on for those 2 or 3 years. And as head of enforcement, I was on most of those calls. We had nationwide calls. Actually, Mark Schoenfeld, the former head of the New York office, was tapped as one of the coordinators of, because obviously the New York office had a lot of these cases as well. And we would have, I believe it was weekly calls. Steve Cutler was on these calls. I was on the calls, and a number of others. And so I would work to be coordinating within my office all the different investigations.
Okay. And is there any element to this whole set of investigations that we haven't really gotten at? I've asked my question.
I think two things that we've already mentioned. One was the importance of close coordination with the exam group. And two is the importance of industry expertise within enforcement.
Okay. The other really specific and high-profile area that I want to ask about is that the Boston office in this period has been noted for, in the case of Harry Markopoulos' whistleblowing on Madoff, the Boston office tends to come out rather well in that story as it's told by Markopoulos. And I'm wondering if you're able to offer any insight on the Boston office's experience with that.
So I knew Harry Markopoulos pretty well. He had come to us a number of times before all of this broke. On other cases, he had come to us with some thoughts about what fund companies were market timing. He had some other observations. And I had seen that he had often a good sense of the market and what was happening. Sometimes the issues that he would raise would be issues that we had already been working on. Other times he provided just really good insight that we then followed up on. And just to, you know, all Harry was able to see is what's on the outside. We had the ability to issue subpoenas and learn information on the inside. So sometimes after we issue those subpoenas or ask those questions, we say, okay, we see why it looked this way from the outside, but it's really something different. There are other times where, you know, what his observations led to was us finding, yeah, this is going on and there's a problem. So my point is I had some experience with Harry prior to 2008 and even prior to I can't remember whether I had it prior to 2005 or not. I think probably in 2004 and 3 is when I first met Harry and talked to him about different issues.
So you weren't privy to when he first came and raised the flag on
when he came in 2000, I was not at the commission. He came in that year and a half period while I was gone. In 2005, he did come. I don't believe that I met with him when he came, but I was very much aware of him coming and meeting. And I do remember that after that meeting, we talked. And, you know, here this was, Harry was raising concerns that the trading methodology utilized by Madoff didn't seem right, and that there was a relatively small accounting firm that was doing the accounting. And that was something that piqued the interest of the head of the office at that time, Walter Ricciardi, because Walter had come from 25 years at PwC, so he knew accounting. But also at that time, we were in a situation where we were trying to figure out how does each office work, what does each office do, what are the cases that each office works on, and here was someone that is working out of New York. And so it just made sense for Walter to send an email down to New York and say, listen, we got this information, don't know what's going to come from it, but you guys should probably take a look. And so, you know, that's kind of where we were coming from, is we learned about something, seemed interesting, and sent it down to New York. You know, there was, obviously after 2008, after Madoff confessed, there was a lot of hand-wringing about what happened and who did what and who knew what. And, you know, what we were focused on during that whole time is we're one agency. And so, you know, maybe if you look back and say different people had different roles and wish this had happened or this had happened, what I always was certain of is that everyone involved in that matter was acting in good faith. And through a combination of resources, maybe through a combination of lack of industry knowledge, we missed it. We missed it as an agency. And so I've never felt like one group should be touting its role while another group should be, you know, essentially punished and vilified. That we're one agency, we missed it, and we learned a lot from it. And that's really where I come out in the whole thing. Even after the Madoff matter came to fruition, we continued to have a good relationship with Harry. He, you know, had interactions with not just me but others, things that he sees. I think that when people heard from him after that, it may have been taken a little differently, given the notoriety of Madoff. But it just highlights the fact that some of our best information is going to come from individuals in the industry, and that no matter how people come across, no matter what you think, if they're coming with information, we just got to make sure we're handling it in the right way.
I gather from what you're saying, the way the story is told, that there was the Boston office and the New York office, there were some frictions there, and that's the reason why it didn't get picked up. I gather that you would disagree with that. Basically,
yeah, I really don't see it resulting from frictions. First of all, I don't have a direct window. Yes, I've read the Inspector General report. I know what's said to have happened. But other than that, I didn't have a direct insight into what was happening at that time. When I read it, it sounded to me like there are resources, there might have been, again, industry knowledge, there might have been a worry about what would happen. Hey, if I subpoena all these counterparties, how am I even going to review all the stuff that comes in? And everyone is extremely sad that it happened in that way. But no, in fact, I thought it was great. I thought this was an example of, you know, working together, partnership. Hey, we found this. It could be hot. We don't know, but it's in your region. Why don't you guys take a look at it? But no, I guess I never felt that set of tensions as being part of any of this.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Very interesting insights on that. So now I guess I'd just like to do more of a survey as to the different kinds of things that
sure.
you would have seen from an enforcement perspective here in Boston. So first, accounting frauds. Of course, the Enron, WorldCom, et cetera, period is not the end of it. You do continue to see cases in this area. I know that GE
yep.
was a big one that you saw here at that time. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about whether the manner of those sorts of cases would have been different in the wake of Sarbanes-Oxley, or would they have still been sort of the same things you would have seen before?
Well, I think it's interesting, because if you look back to WorldCom, Enron, you don't see that kind of case as in the same way ever since Sarbanes-Oxley has come into being. And, you know, an argument could be made that more regulation and more attention to controls has really made a difference there. Yes, there continue to be financial statement cases, financial fraud cases, but the size and volume and nature of them, I think, is different. So back then, it'd be a lot of revenue recognition cases and a lot about timing of revenue recognition. And then, you know, your cases where the revenue was non-existent, that's true too. You know, round-trip transactions, all those kinds of things. You know, one of the things that we always looked for, and of course now you know there's a new task force, the Financial Fraud Task Force, mm-hmm. that was set up after I left the SEC. It was headed by David Woodcock, who's now gone, but really set up a great task force that's doing a lot of analytics mm-hmm. into the financial statements. Well, we didn't have the analytics piece at that point, but we would look for, you know, consistently making the earnings consensus, meeting earnings consensus every single quarter. We'd look for things like that. And I think the important thing for the SEC is always to remain vigilant in an area, even if you think that it's been cleaned up somewhat. Mm-hmm. Because if you think it's been cleaned up and you walk away, you know, the problems and abuses creep back in. And so that's always been, financial statement fraud has not been as high in a volume since the Sarbanes-Oxley era. And people say, well, is that because there's less fraud? Well, I think there is certainly less of the type of fraud that it was meant to address. I think that there may be other practices that have crept in. But I also think you look at it as, you know, perhaps there's been some success here. Perhaps mm-hmm. firms are putting enough into their resources, into their internal controls, into this space, that they're saying, you know what, I'm going to pay for the right person to do this. I'm going to make sure that we're looking for the right structure, infrastructure. So, again, it's never something you want to get away from, and I think the new task force is designed to do just that, is make sure, what are we missing? What are the analytics that may be showing that there's still financial statement problems mm-hmm. and that we need to go after them? But I do think that some of the problems that we saw in the early 2000s actually have diminished.
A couple of people have told me about the importance of journalism in bringing one's attention to these kinds of cases, particularly in that circa 2000 period. Was that your experience, that you'd look for restatements of earnings and then kind of hone in on what was the cause of those?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point. When we saw that, whether it's a restatement or we saw a CFO step down or some other significant or a change in auditors, that would be a prompt for us to say, you know, let's call the company and let's say, what's going on? Or say to the company, we'd like to talk to the CFO that's stepping down. We'd like to understand the reasons why. Now, companies have more and more in the last 15 years understood that they will be getting a call, and so they proactively call and say, hey, we want you to know this is going to happen. Here's why. Happy to share with you the reasons that this change is happening. But yes, yeah, so that would be, at that point, our source of information really was the press.
Mm-hmm. Does this analytics bit kind of supersede that in a way? It allows you to detect these things without having a beat reporter on
it? Yeah, I think so. I think that seeing the analytics of the, you know, just the actual reporting, the Edgar filings, that those, they're now in databases that as soon as it hits, you get it, and you're not actually just trolling through the papers to find things. So I think, yes, that is true. It doesn't take away the importance of good financial reporters identifying a potential abuse in the market and people within enforcement saying, well, wait a second, that's interesting. Let's get more information about it. So I think even up until the time I left and even now, there's still a wonderful opportunity for a good investigative journalist, not even on a particular issuer or a particular company, but more broadly, maybe an industry practice, say, this doesn't seem right, and that could prompt a greater attention from the enforcement staff, who is overwhelmed, tapped out, lots of things going on, and sometimes it's just helpful to have that brought to their attention. Now, with that said, the influx of more expertise, greater expertise into the enforcement division also serves that purpose. So you have people that have been in the industry that have come into the enforcement division as specialists and said, hey, this was a practice that I always thought was, you know, out of whack. Now I'm here, I'm telling you about it. So it comes from both directions. But there's still a role for the news in prompting work.
As long as we're on that subject, I have sort of a superficial impression that the Boston Globe actually has a fairly, compared to, say, maybe other regional areas, a fairly developed financial beat. Is that your experience?
It was while I was there. I mean, obviously, every paper, and that includes the Boston Globe, has gone through a downsizing, which means less attention and depth in every area necessarily exists because mm-hmm. there's fewer people. But there's a few reporters at the Globe, including reporters that are still there, that just kept digging and keep digging, and that's, you know, that can be very helpful just to get an issue out there.
When they decide to pay attention to a case, is it your experience that they pick the ones that are significant or the ones that are interesting in some way? Because when one's doing research for these pieces, of course, we look at the newspaper archives, and sometimes it seems to be, for whatever reason, say an insider trading case or some sort of scam or something like that piques their attention.
Yeah. Well, there's always, you know, from the press perspective, I think you always are looking for the hook. What would people be interested in reading about? And some of the stuff that we do doesn't have, like, a great reader's hook, but it's really important. So I think it varied. I think when we would end up, well, either when they were conducting investigative journalism or when we would end up filing a case, we'd get the most press when it was an issue that had all the elements. So it might be a very senior executive that was involved, or it might be, you know, the amount of money that was involved. So, you know, that's just natural. I mean, you're writing because people are reading. And so you're not necessarily going to write about an esoteric change in the rules that actually ends up being very significant if you can't bring it down to a public understanding of what went on. But I've never felt that was that big a handicap. I think that what we always liked is when we did bring our cases, that helped us from a prophylactic perspective. It was a deterrent because we can't get to every single company. When I was at the SEC, we can't get to every activity, but if people know we're on the beat, that we're on the job, then that might deter additional conduct. So the press, in my opinion, didn't always have the same objectives that the SEC did, but was a really good avenue to get the message out.
Concerning the Boston region, were there cases that had a certain Boston flavor? I guess what I'm thinking, we've discussed things like investment management company, Connecticut hedge funds, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But I'm also thinking of the high-tech sector here, and if there were aggressive IPO markets and
yeah, it was especially back
that arose from that.
Yeah, I think again, back in the early 2000s, the IPOs was something that we would focus on a lot, really, before the market went in the early 2000s. But then, in addition, I think that there were cases that we brought that sometimes involved prominent politicians or prominent business executives, and you know, that were you know, uniquely Boston or uniquely New England. And that always brought a lot of more intention, or venerable companies, you know, companies that they're, you think of that company, you think of Boston, you think of New England. And, you know, I guess that tees up another issue, which is there's always this question of how hard does someone in enforcement seek to enforce the law if they think that they won't be in government forever. And especially if you think, well, I'll be in Boston forever, so what consequences is this going to have in my future? I just never really saw that kind of thinking at the SEC in Boston or anywhere, even when I was down in Washington. I saw people just excited to say, what's the next violation and how are investors being harmed? without regard to, well, how does this affect my future? And I would just say that because that to me was really important, is that we have a mission here, and we're going to be true to our mission, and that's what we're all about.
Do you have particular strategies that you, shifting gears, do you have strategies that you used in terms of looking at companies and their culpability for employee actions? I know I ran into a couple newspaper accounts of cases like that. Were you generally able to go after supervisory negligence, or was that something that was challenging to bring?
So it depended on the situation. I think the more that we saw that the red flags went to the very top and that they seemed to be tolerated or even encouraged, the more important it was for us to hold that company accountable, not just the employee.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a very fine line that we were trying to draw, and you know, we had some judges draw it, between failure to supervise and actual participation in the conduct itself. And you know, as I look back, I think the most important thing was just making sure that companies understood their obligation to make sure their employees are getting it right. And if they see that that's not happening, to step in and make sure that they hold them accountable and take care of things on their own. And so, for me, the lesson learned that I think was the most important, or that I would have wanted companies to learn, is you just got to follow up. You got to pay attention, and you got to make sure your employees are doing the right thing. Ultimately, do you get hit with a fraud charge, or do you get hit with a failure to supervise charge? It's not that it's not important. It's incredibly important. But you get hit with neither if you're able to supervise your employees and follow up on the red flags.
When you're going up the ladder, what are the key criteria for delineating whether you're going to bring an enforcement action against a company versus certain executives?
Well, that's a really good question. I think for me, the more the executive is involved in the conduct and actually either directly engaging in it or aiding and abetting the conduct, the more likely it is you say, all right, should this person be charged? There is a very clear separation that towards the end of my tenure I think was made even clearer, and that is if you've got a fraud charge, if you think it's a fraud charge is appropriate against the company, then there's got to be a person that committed it, because you can't just take this nebulous fraud and say no individual committed it. There are fraud charges that the SEC has brought and authorized without individuals, and that is a situation where there's not one individual, but there's several that between them, their knowledge and their conduct led to a fraud charge. Even those cases were hard. But once you have fraud, it's hard not to have an individual. On the other hand, if you have non-scienter or negligence-based charges, those are charges where you really have to think about what individuals would be charged and whether they're charged. And that's a more case-by-case scenario.
And then on the level of not particularly companies, but some of these petty cases, we talked a little bit earlier about Ponzi schemes, boiler room schemes, that sort of thing. I mean, you would continuously see these. Was there a cyclicality to them? Was there an evolution in their nature? Did they move more towards the internet, for example, over time, or were there any other changes in their characteristics?
Yeah. So there were a number of trends, and you identified them. You know, there are trends that are driven by improvements in technology. You know, the issue was often the SEC was behind the new technology, so it would always be playing catch up. When new technology is used to perpetrate a fraud or a scheme, then we had to figure out new ways to catch it. But I guess the other thing I'd say is, in many ways, those were some of the most important cases. And even if those cases involved, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 lost, they're more important than some cases where it's $10 million, because they were real people with life savings totaling $75,000 and they lost everything. And in some of those cases, they mortgaged their homes at the suggestion of the person committing the fraud so that they could gain, they mortgaged their homes so they could invest more money.
Yeah, I noticed you did an interview, I think, a couple of years ago where you were talking about things like affinity fraud and those being particularly prominent cases.
Yeah, and that's a big piece of these cases where the frauds are perpetrated on the friends and family. You mm-hmm. know, you join a church or you're part of an ethnic group and you find someone else in your group that is either really happy with someone they're investing with or that they're they're talking up an investment, and you have every reason in the world to trust them because you both are together in whatever effort you're involved in or whatever group you're involved in. And those are some of the saddest stories because they're family members that were defrauded, right? They're lifelong friends that were defrauded. And so you look at those things, you think, wow, this really is an important mission. And you want to get into the sophisticated frauds and the sophisticated violations because that can protect millions of people. But you can never lose track and lose sight of the retail frauds that involve 2 people or 10 people or 30 people and, you know, losses of maybe a total of $1 million, because those are people that's changed their lives.
In terms of your ability to obtain restitution for victims, I ran into one newspaper article where it was notable that you're actually able to get 90% back in this particular case, and that actually it's very rare to be able to make people close to whole when you do discover these things.
Yeah, that's true, and that's the other sad part of these stories is that by the time the SEC learns about it, the money is often gone. Now, we do have temporary, you know, we have emergency court action authority. We can go, we can try to freeze assets, and sometimes we'll get them. But often, by the time we learn of it, the money's gone through 17 different accounts and it's been dissipated, or it's just, you just can't find it. So that's, again, sad. The sad story, not just that people are defrauded, but that they really are not going to have a chance to get their money back.
And then there was one or two other cases that just seemed notable for their novelty. For example, there was, I think, a fund, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was investing in socially responsible investments, and it turned out they were not. That their screening criteria were being violated.
Yep.
Was that kind of a new thing that one would see this sort of behavior, given the fact that socially responsible funds themselves are rather new?
Yeah. So there was an aspect that was new and an aspect that wasn't. The aspect that was new was that it was the first case that had been brought relating to socially responsible criteria and whether or not they were complying with them. The aspect that wasn't is, it comes back to what I said a number of times, is what did you say about what you were going to do and what did you do? And comparing the two leads to a determination of whether you met your word to investors or whether you broke your word to investors. And in that case, very similar to all the cases that are brought in this space over the years, is they didn't do what they said they would do. And in this case, they said they would be socially responsible and follow these criteria, and they didn't. But most cases just still boil down to, were you telling the truth? Are you complying with your practices? Are you taking good care of shareholders and their money?
So I want to come back, at least for a moment, to your career. You become the director of the Boston office in 2006. Tell me about the shift in responsibilities there.
Well, it was really interesting. I had worked closely with a number of the members of the exam group already, but becoming director gave me responsibility for both sides of the office, both enforcement and exam. And I loved it because the people in the Boston office were fantastic, just really committed, really hard workers. There's always issues to work through and resolve, but really people were committed to the cause. And what I was able to do as head of the office is even more be able to understand the interaction between enforcement and exam and be involved in meetings with both teams and make sure that if I felt like there was something happening on one side of the office the other side didn't know about, than to bring people together. So I really enjoyed that. I also enjoyed the opportunity to interact with other office heads across the country. You know, there were 12 regional offices, and it was just a good experience to be able to do that.
Were there particular things that you were able to do from a managerial perspective, or was it mainly just this coordination between different groups?
Oh, you know, I tried to use, my philosophy always has been to help people to advance their lives, their careers, to find the right work-life balance. You know, I'm firmly of the view that we need to make it a good atmosphere, make our workplace a good atmosphere for people, because we spend more of our time awake with our work colleagues than with our families or friends. And so I was always interested in finding ways to do that and very open to alternative work schedules. Because my philosophy is if you're good in the office, you're going to do a good job outside the office. It's just if that's the kind of employee you are. And so we want to make it easier for people to be productive, but also to be with their family, with their friends, you know, just have that balance, but work really hard, because that's what I found is people really worked hard. So I guess that was one important thing for me. The other thing is probably a couple years before I left, we had formed the Boston Regional Office Diversity and Inclusion Committee and tried to focus on not just hiring and diversity practices, but more broadly, how are we bringing everybody along? How are we making sure that people have opportunities to advance, to grow, to develop, and what are we doing to encourage that? And then on the pure hiring practices and promotion, what are we doing to make sure we have a very diverse candidate pool? What are we doing to make sure that it's not just people that are relying on their connections to get jobs, but that we're saying, well, how do we find the best team out there? How do we find a team that's very diverse in perspective and experience, because that's going to bring us to a better place. We're going to make better decisions when we have a team that's thinking in many different ways.
A couple years before you left the SEC, you won a couple of different awards, and I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your activities in these areas. One is law and policy. What were your interests there?
Well, I spent a lot of time in 2010 and 11 working with a small group on whistleblower rules. We worked together on the legislation that was proposed. Well, first proposing this to the administration, then legislation that was proposed both by the House and the Senate, and then finally working after Dodd-Frank was passed with a whistleblower provision, working on the SEC rules for the whistleblowers. And that was a great experience. We worked, you know, together with members of the General Counsel's office, a few other members of enforcement, and other members of the team, just really understanding what is it that we need to do? How do we encourage whistleblowers to come forward? How do we do it in a way that doesn't supplant the companies as a resource and as entities that want to get it right too? So that was a really interesting experience. Mm.
What were some of the main things that you were trying to balance there? I mean, I've had a couple other discussions with that, because I know that they start giving higher rewards to whistleblowers and after Dodd-Frank, and separate question, I guess. Were you able to draw on the kind of the lessons learned in the Boston office from your experiences with whistleblowers previously to 2000?
So I think one of the big issues that was significantly controversial was whether we would require a whistleblower to go first to his or her own company to report it before coming to the SEC. The industry generally was saying, if you don't require reporting to us first, we have no way to address these issues, and we're not going to be able to make it better. It's going to take you reaching out to us and bringing an action against us to make it better, and that's not a good way to operate. It's not good corporate governance. Our concern was that if we required whistleblowers to report first to their company, we couldn't assess that the strength of that company's whistleblower program before requiring that. So there might be a program where the whistleblower wants to report on the very people running that program or the very people that would hear about that and put themselves in danger of either losing their job or other things that could come of that. On the other hand, we understood that we did want companies to act on their own to improve their systems and controls and procedures. And the best way that we learn is from individuals that are inside. Same thing with companies. The best way they learn about problems. So we ended up with what we thought was the right compromise, and that is that you don't have to bring it to your company first, but that if you do bring it to your company first and then later come to the SEC, you get credit from, you know, for having brought it to your company. And if your company does an awful lot of work and brings it to the SEC, you get credit for all the work that your company did to dig into the problem. I don't think everyone loved that, but it was where we felt what we thought was important in balancing those aspects. I think it was just interesting. I think the program has worked. I mean, there's cases that came out of it that I don't think we ever would have heard about. Our office was actually involved in granting the last bounty that came from the whistleblower bounty the insider trading bounty program before the whistleblower program. That was about $1 million, and it was to the former wife of a tipper in a hedge fund insider trading case. And that was, so it would have been just, you know, the day before the new program went into effect, the last payment was $1 million. So we'd had some experience, as you said, with whistleblowers for a number of years. And I also had done a whistleblower case in private practice, more traditional. It was a False Claims Act case. So had that background and experience too. And when we worked on it, we also spoke to the DOJ and the IRS about their program. So great experience.
Okay, the other area is labor management relations. I guess you got an award there too in 2011 and 2012. I'm curious about your interest in that area.
Yeah, it does. It brings me back to the points I was making before. Is I think that it's really important that we don't rely so much on hierarchy to make sure you're getting it right, but you want to bring in everybody, every person, and every group that has an interest in what you're doing. And so the SEC has had a union since the early 2000s, and the president of the chapter for the SEC happens to be in Boston. And so over the years, I think he and I developed a very strong relationship, and I came to the conclusion that, yes, I'm in management, and I can do certain things, but if I team up with the union and saying, hey, here's what we'd like to accomplish, this is what I'm thinking, that the union may actually have some thoughts and ideas that make it better. And so again, it's just the idea of working together and teaming with, you know, all the constituents to make the end product better.
So you've had the opportunity to work under several different division directors in enforcement. I'm wondering if you can characterize if there are stylistic differences in how the division has operated, particularly with respect to the regional office under them.
So my experience has been influenced by how closely I've worked with the directors. And so it's not as if I can really say I had the same level of experience with each director, and so this is how I rate them or rank them. I do think that Rob Kazami, when he came in, he really was looking to figure out how do we move to the next level? And even though he brought in a few people from the outside, he also relied on the current structure and leaders to say, what should we do differently? And so what I really liked about that is he had a great amount of reliance on both the regional offices, the home office, and said, how do we just make this work? I worked a lot with Rob and with a team that really restructured enforcement. You know, we eliminated branch chiefs as a management layer, created the specialized units. And so I just felt very engaged with Rob. Steve Cutler and Linda Thompson, I think they did great work. You know, I remember I came back to Linda and what she had always said about what we need to be doing. But I just ended up working a lot more closely, and that was because I was head of the office. I was one of the office heads. So I think they were all really great in their own space, and I really enjoyed working even more closely when Rob came, and of course when George Kanellis was deputy and then was appointed acting director and I was acting deputy director. You know, I couldn't say nicer things about George. I just think he's awesome, just a wonderful guy.
Tell me a little bit about that position. It was the last one you had before you left. Had you resolved that you were going to leave the SEC when you took that position?
Yes. So back in 2012, I was exploring opportunities to leave and went down and spoke to some folks in D.C. and, you know, really put it on hold because of the idea that, you know what, I might be able to help down there for a period of time. I didn't actually think it was going to be even 5 months. I thought it would be shorter than that. But, you know, I just have a great respect for the leaders of the SEC and a great respect for the institution. And from my perspective, if there was anything that I could do to help down there, I would absolutely do it and wouldn't let the desire to depart from the SEC get in the way. So that was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And my colleagues throughout all the offices were so welcoming, and it was really easy to move into that role because I had really good relationships with all the people throughout the country.
What were your particular responsibilities?
Well, George just really partnered with me. So we would talk about cases. We would do case reviews of different offices. We would there would be, you know, some cases where George would say, hey, can you take this? And I'd be the one to meet with the attorneys coming in to talk about the case. So it was just really a partnership to have conversations with the commissioners. When Mary Jo came in, George and I and Joe Brenner, Office of Chief Counsel, went and met with her a few times about enforcement before Andrew arrived. So, you know, there was policy, there were legal decisions, there was analysis, there were meetings, and commission meetings. You know, of course, every single week we'd have the closed commission meetings, and George and I and Joe and a few others would, and Matt Martins, head of the trial unit, would be there and provide insight from the perspective of the division on particular cases. It's just wonderful.
Going back to the formulation of these more specialized enforcement groups, when did that come into place exactly, and what was driving that at that particular time?
So that came into place in the summer of 2009. Rob joined earlier that year. And what was driving that was, once again, it was kind of like what I was talking about in 2003 and 2004, is how do you get even more expertise and knowledge into the Division of Enforcement? And maybe the way you do it is not by having everyone be generalists, but let's get some specialists in here. And so, you know, we talked a lot about, well, what does that mean? What should it look like? Should the entire division be all specialty units? Should some of it be more general? And so there were a lot of discussions, and we ended up, you know, landing on 5 specialized units in 5 areas that we thought really required a lot of expertise and knowledge, and where there was a lot of potential misconduct. And then with the knowledge that didn't mean that those units were the only ones doing that kind of case, but that they would bring a lot of expertise to it, and that all the other staff members were going to be working sometimes on cases within those 5 groups, sometimes on other cases, but that we really want to take advantage of the expertise. And so we hired in, say, take the asset management unit. We hired in specialized senior special examiners senior specialized experts, subject matter experts that came from industry. And they would say, hey, when you're seeing this, this is what it means. What a difference that makes, you know, because if all you have are your legal team and your accountants and not someone coming from the industry, it's harder to understand what makes things happen.
Was that organization at the regional level as well, or were those units kind of headquartered in Washington?
No, they were. It was across the country.
Okay.
So we ended up the first group of regional office. The first group of specialized units had heads of the units. Some in Washington, I believe. We had 2 in Philadelphia. I can't remember whether we started out with one in New York. Yes, we had co-heads. We had one. For asset management, we had co-heads, we had one in New York and one in D.C. So it really was across the offices. And then every office determined how many units it was going to have in its office. There were only 2 offices at first that decided they were going to have all 5 units. Because it was, you know, a bit of loss of autonomy, right? Because those heads were in other cities, other offices. But Boston and L.A. were the 2 offices that ended up saying, we're going to have all 5 to start. And I think it's been a great experience. Every change like that takes time. And there was an adjustment period to, you know, who's in charge of what, who's responsible. You have a unit head that's making a decision about a case, but if the case is litigated, then the litigation staff may be coming from the office and the office head may be in charge. So there had to be coordination. Some of the coordinations work better than others, but ultimately getting that expertise into the division, I think, was a good thing.
Now, you had we talked about division directors, but of course the commission itself has changed over time, and I've spoken to some of the commissioners. I know that there are divergent opinions on which cases ultimately should be brought, penalty levels, that sort of thing, as to, of course, differences of opinion as to whether or not enforcement should be a policy tool. Would that be something that you would have to contend with at the regional level, or was that something?
Sure. So depending on the case that we brought, I'd be down in D.C. talking to commissioners asking really probing questions. Why are we doing this? What's the reason for doing this? What end does this accomplish? And each commissioner would have a different perspective, And, you know, my role was just to, you know, have respect for each perspective and say, this is why we think this makes sense. Different commissioners were interested in different things. But I found those conversations really interesting. Not always easy, right? I wouldn't always have the answer that a commissioner was looking for. But, you know, our goal was just to say, listen, we're here to hold accountable those who commit, who are engaged in misconduct. This is how we think it should happen. And the commissioners, they're the boss. They're the client. So they have a right to ask every question. And there'll be times where we'd take a settlement that we proposed and say, well, we can make this change if that makes it easier for my collective client mm-hmm. to approve the settlement.
You'll have to remind me of the proper terminology, but I guess that it's Mary Shapiro who allows the enforcement division to, I guess, authorize investigations.
Mm-hmm. Issue subpoenas,
having,
really.
Right, rather than having that happen at the commission.
Yep, that was in 2009 as well.
Right, was that something, is that something that takes place then in Washington, or does that do all the regional offices?
Oh, all the regional offices. So
handle that separately.
The authority was given to the head of each office and the head of enforcement for each office.
Ah, okay.
And that was a sea change,
yeah.
Just a gigantic change, allowed more autonomy in terms of just saying, listen, we got to investigate this. We know it's an investigation. We know the commission would think it's an investigation, because all you're trying to see is, are there possible violations?
Mm-hmm.
So being able to put the issuance of the subpoenas in the hands of the individual offices was a big, big step.
Mm. And then also, of course, tell me a little bit about the evolution of your relations with criminal investigations. Was that something that you were always doing, or was that something that developed more over time?
In Boston, we always had a pretty robust, close relationship with the Economic Crimes Unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Boston. I remember different heads of that unit coming over. We would have periodic meetings. We'd talk about cases. So I would say for at least a 10-year period, there was a lot of interaction. I think it only strengthened. I think, you know, we actually hired a former prosecutor from the U.S. Attorney's Office. It always helps when you have people, you kind of back and forth between those offices. It makes you even more sensitive and thoughtful about, well, maybe this is something that they should know. So, you know, I think the trend was always towards stronger. But even in the earlier 2000s, we really did meet with and talk to and coordinate with. I remember cases, you know, we appointed a number of our attorneys as special assistant prosecutors, even in the early 2000s. I remember two of our attorneys, Sandy Bailey and Scott Pomfret, tried a case with Paul Levinson, the current head of the Boston office, when he was head. He wasn't even head. He was a member of the Economic Crimes Unit, and they tried a case with him against someone who had lied to the SEC and got a conviction. And that was probably mid-2000s. So, long time, strong relationships continued to grow.
So, Dodd-Frank, as those rules started to come into effect, did those have, were there ones that had a particular impact on your activities in the Boston office?
Dodd-Frank gave the SEC staff more powers, allowed us to bring more cases in the administrative law context. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussions about that recently. But I would say, in my opinion, the biggest change was the whistleblower mm-hmm. Provision, because it did give a much greater incentive to people who would be in the middle of misconduct seeing it to come forward.
Okay. Just look over my notes to see if I'm missing anything, but I think I've actually gone quite a bit through my list. Is there
okay.
anything? We've been going for quite a while, and I've exercised your vocal cords quite a bit here, but is there anything in particular that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to?
I think the experience of working at the SEC was one of the best experiences of my life. The people, the mission were so aligned, and it was just incredibly rewarding. So I will always treasure those years, and would never rule out the possible future of coming back and helping out again in some capacity. But no, it was just a great experience. I think you did a great job covering all the issues. You clearly did a lot of research on this.
Thanks. So let me just ask you then, what is it that made you decide to move on?
I guess I felt that I had come to the point where I had learned a lot. I had really gone as far as I could in Boston and, you know, spent 7 years learning that job. It was a great experience to be in D.C. for a time, but wasn't really contemplating moving in the public sector to D.C. at that point. And also thought, you know, it's always good, it could be good for the Boston office to see a change too. So I thought this would be a time for me to go to the private sector. I have kids, and seeing what potential opportunities to help my family there'd be financially. But also that it seemed to come to a good point. I had had great experience, first as an office head, then working closely with Rob Kazami and other office heads in helping to change the nature of the enforcement division. And then I also was working on the OC side, the exam side, with Carla DeFlorio and Norm Champ, and helped restructure that. So I had some great experiences. This has been great, and now I'm ready to make a change. But I never thought that I'd be leaving to go to an experience that was going to be better. It was just going to be different. Because I think public service is one of the most wonderful things that you can do. And that just was reaffirmed for me every year I was there. Even though there were some years that were tough. There were some years where coming in, the papers would be, you know, excoriating the SEC. But I knew what our mission was, and I knew how important it was, and I knew that I was going into a group of people that cared about it, and that made all the difference.
One question that I ought to have asked earlier, but I just skipped over it, so this is out of sequence. Okay. But I'm wondering about, I know that there were some cases while we were at the Boston office in the hedge fund area, and I know that those only became registered after Dodd-Frank. Did that make any difference in that area, whether or not hedge funds were registered in terms of the ability to detect things going on there?
It made a big difference in terms of the fact that prior to that, we didn't have inspection authority, right? So we couldn't go in and say, give us your records, show us what you're doing, show us what you're saying. We always had jurisdiction over fraud. So hedge funds were responsible for complying with Section 206 of the Advisors Act. You got to, again, don't lie, cheat, and steal. And so we certainly had cases, Rule 105, trading cases, other types of cases, and sometimes just plain out fraud cases against hedge funds, insider trading cases, all of those could still happen. The change was, though, that when we got inspection authority, we could look more broadly at the conduct internally. And so I think that did help both the industry and regulators come to a different place as far as certain practices that may have been less prominent prior to the changes.
Okay, thank you. Finally, you've been out of the SEC for a while. You're back in the financial area. So you had previously spent that year and a half at what was it?
Tucker Anthony.
Tucker Anthony, yeah. Is it a similar experience? Is it a different experience this time around?
It's
a different kind of company.
But. Yeah, it's a different experience. I mean, both were broker-dealers. Yeah. Tucker Anthony was quite a bit smaller. LPL Financial is about 14,000 brokers and 3,300 employees. And then we support another 4,000 or 5,000 advisors on the insurance side. So, you know, altogether, it's 20,000 people to think about and make sure we have the right systems in place. LPL is also a company that grew very fast, and its infrastructure didn't grow with it. So it's been on a journey, this company, in a really positive way to say, okay, we're going to strengthen our infrastructure. We're going to make sure that we have the right procedures in place. So, yes, it's been different in the sense that I am really trying to help guide the company through that. But I think one thing that's been impressed upon me is how important some of the speeches I made about culture really are. Mm-hmm. The culture is so important in a private company, and I feel very good about the culture here. I feel really good about the commitment of our top leadership to making things happen the right way for investors. So that's been encouraging, and things move fast. You know, when you're at the SEC, the people that are subject of investigations are happy for you to take your time, have meeting after meeting after meeting. Here, you just got to move forward and make the best decisions you can, and make reasonable decisions. But you know, this is a business, and you've got to make those decisions and strike that right balance, making sure that investors are protected and that at the same time the business can be successful.
All right. Well, I think that brings us up to the present. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Back, please do. But otherwise,
no, perfect. That's great. Here's a card in case you have a question that comes up.